Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay, and you may or may not know that starting on Monday, it's Mental Health Awareness Week. So in honour of that, our show today is exploring how perceptions of mental health have changed over time. And one of our best insights into this is through literature and the medium of the novel. But this is a science show, I hear you say. I know, and I'm going to be a little bit out of my comfort zone, but I think it's fascinating and important to see how society's ideas about what the human experience is have been influenced by developing scientific theories about the mind and how the brain works. The raving hysteria of a Victorian lady might have been attributed to her wandering womb, but then by the 60s, we believed in drugs and medication, and there was a terrifying lack of understanding, as is so clearly illustrated in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Equally, there is power in a story to really convey someone else's experience and build empathy and understanding for those different experiences that we might never have ourselves. So, joining me today to share his expertise in this fascinating area is Dr. John Day, a lecturer at King's College University who specialises in philosophy of mind, neurology and modern literature. Welcome, John.
Hello, thanks for having me.
What an amazing kind of niche area to be in. It's so interesting.
I'm glad you think so.
We've been talking, well, in my introduction, I have been talking about how our ideas about the mind have changed. I mean, what would you say is the current idea about our minds?
Well, I mean, there are, within kind of philosophy of mind, which is the sub-discipline of philosophy that deals with these kinds of questions in big abstract terms, there are loads of competing accounts. But I would say kind of culturally and in popular science and culture, our understanding of what the mind is very materialist and has been for the last 20 years. So Our kind of the explanations that we seek to provide for how what our minds are and how our minds function is derived from brain science and neuroscience. And there's a physician and brilliant writer called Raymond Tallis who has diagnosed this condition as a bad thing, with the term he uses, which is neuromania. He suggests that there's a kind of addiction to reductive narratives of mind and mental experiences that are always neurological, that is actually quite dangerous and kind of suggests that we are nothing more than our brains, which he's against. And I think one thing that the novel can do and the arts more broadly is kind of challenge those reductive readings of what it is to be an embodied mind,
yeah,
what it is to have a mind.
I mean, I think that I do naturally do that. Like, I love to understand, oh, why do I feel this way? What's triggering that feeling, like, in my head or in my body? And how do those things connect? And it can be quite easy to overanalyze yourself and kind of...
Or just think that that's the end point. You know, there's something very seductive about pointing to an fMRI scan of a brain and saying, oh, look, we have identified the love neuron or whatever it would be in a particular study. And I think that actually doesn't get you any closer to experiencing or knowing about what the philosopher Thomas Nagel calls the what-is-it-likeness of mental experience.
That's so true. I mean, Romeo and Juliet would be very different if it was like, my oxytocin is being
aroused when
I see you on a balcony.
The literary critic in the 50s, Lionel Trilling, wrote an essay called The Meaning of a Literary Idea, and he said, you know, very soon people will be unable to say they fell in love and got married, but will have to say their libidinal impulses being reciprocal. And obviously the language he was kind of opposed to was that of Freudian psychoanalysis, and the thing he predicted never came to pass. But I think there's something that we explain happiness in terms of dopamine or whatever it might be. You know, these kinds of paradigms are quite... Well, I just think they're uninteresting, they're limiting. Even if they're not dangerous, they are not the whole story.
Yeah, there's a kind of sad sense of inevitability with, like, people falling in love, and it was just, you know, their hormones peaked at the right time instead of this moment of spontaneity and metaphor and beauty and poetry that we love to read.
Yeah. Well, I suppose for a previous generation, you know, genetic explanations for human behaviours were on the ascendant. So perhaps during the 70s and 80s when we cracked the DNA code, you know, those... So another thing that Tallis writes about in his book Aping Mankind is the kind of Darwinitis, he calls it, this idea that evolutionary psychology is the only game in town now, that the only explanations have to be to do with propagating our own genes. And
yeah,
that seems equally depressing to me.
I can see that as being... I can see why that has become a thing. Well, I mean, we're going to be talking a lot more about this later in the show. So for anyone listening... We will also be having as our interactive section, because not even I could stretch an experiment out of the theme this week, but our interactive section, each of us in the studio is going to be sharing an extract from a book that changed the way we thought about some aspect of mental health. And so if you're listening along at home, please tweet us with anything that's changed your views as well, anything you've read, a book or a poem or anything. We'd love to hear from you. So that's at Science Mixtape. And you've already heard her voice, but we have lovely producer Iman back in the studio. She has got our weekly brain teaser to get our mental faculties thinking this morning. So take it away, Iman.
So more trivia than riddle today, your brain teaser is, which 19th century piece of literature came up with the Big Bang Theory before the scientists? So if you think you know the answer, please tweet me in and I will happily retweet and interact and jump for joy. So which 19th century piece of literature got there before the scientists?
I just think that's incredible that a novelist or a writer had such imagination to come up with.
Is it just the phrase or the thesis?
No, the thesis. I think if you break down the analysis, you can get like Newtonian laws out of it.
That's incredible.
They were very accurate.
On that note, John, today is your mixtape, so what song are we kicking off with?
We are kicking off with, well, it's quite obvious and sorry, familiar to all of you, but it's Rock and Roll Suicide by David Bowie. I was surprised how sad I was when Bowie died. I'm sure there's a neurological explanation for the weeping that occurred in our household that day, but actually the music says it all.
You're a rock and roll suicide. Shift break the snarling as you stumble across the road. But the day breaks instead, so you hurry home. Don't let the sun blast your shadow. Don't let the milk float rob your mind. They're so natural, religiously unkind. Oh no, love, you're not alone. You're watching yourself, but you're too unfair. You've got your head all tangled up, but I'm fucking only man.
Examine for a moment an ordinary mind on an ordinary day. The mind receives a myriad of impressions, trivial, fantastic, evanescent, or engraved with the sharpness of steel. From all sides they come, an incessant shower of innumerable atoms, as they fall, as they shape themselves into the life of Monday or Tuesday. That's from Virginia Woolf from Modern Fiction, 1919.
Exactly. Instead of reading you a series of facts this week, we're bringing you some amazing quotations that we think capture new ideas or old ideas about the mind. Moving on from that, though, we started talking about the current idea that we have. But John, can you take us back to sort of the earlier ideas of the mind that we see in literature?
In literature or in culture or both, I suppose. Yeah,
both. Yeah. I see literature as a reflection of culture. I hope that's correct.
Like, yeah, no, that's I mean, that's exactly how I see it too. I think, I suppose what's interesting from my perspective is the idea that certain, the notion of what a mind is and what it is to have one has changed significantly. It's a historically contingent construction, and we often think of it as a kind of essential thing, like a scientific law or a principle of some kind. And actually, I'm always interested in ways in which culture and literary ideas and aesthetic ideas inform scientific or psychological understandings.
Yeah, absolutely. That they don't happen in isolation, and events in the world will, as well as like new theories that people are having, events will shape and impact on those.
Quite, and that can happen in a very kind of local and specific way. Iman's question about the Big Bang being kind of anticipated by fiction is one manifestation of that. I know, you know, scientists always, or literary people always, like the idea that James Joyce came up with the notion of the cork in Finnegan's Wake. It was a word that was borrowed from literature.
Oh, wait, so we didn't have corks in bottles before that.
No, quark, you know, quark, quark,
oh,
quark.
Yeah, sorry.
Depends how you pronounce it. The elementary part, the elemental particle.
Quarks,
yes. Yeah, yeah. I think with the Irish inflection,
cool.
I'd say quark. Yeah, yeah, so it's kind of borrowed from literature. But in terms of the mind, I suppose the notion of kind of what a mind is owes, in modern day, in contemporary culture, in the last 500 years or so, owes a great deal to the work of René Descartes, the Enlightenment philosopher, who famously came up with the phrase cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am, as a kind of starting principle in a new philosophy of science. In the Meditations, Descartes wanted to get rid of anything that could be doubted about our world in order to find what he thought of as the foundations for a new science. Yep. And after these many stages of doubt, the thing he came up with is there is a mind and it has thoughts. Mm. That's all we can assert. And then did a bit of...
what he means by I think, therefore I am. Yeah. Like this thing that is thinking...
can't be doubted.
Yeah.
In Scottish Enlightenment philosopher David Hume then kind of actually said, you can, just because there are thoughts doesn't mean there is a thing thinking those thoughts. So the kind of Cartesian notion of a thinker is, I'm afraid, this is how philosophy of mind goes very quickly. But really Hume said all you can assert is there are thoughts. Thoughts exist. It doesn't, just in the same way as, you know, we couldn't necessarily... I mean, he kind of...
Don't thoughts need to be generated? Don't they need a thinker?
Well, this is what Descartes would have us believe, and we still labour under his legacy. So we still very much have a model of cognition, which is that of the homunculus, the cogito, the thing that's the consciousness that resides in a body and looks through the world.
But you can't have consciousness without a body. You have your mind and your body.
Descartes said you could. He said that the body and mind are completely different things, and actually the mind should be thought of as a kind of outrider. So the phrase used by modern neurosciences or philosophy of mind is the Cartesian theatre, the idea that there's a little person sitting in our brain somewhere. Descartes said it was in the pineal gland because that was the only part of the brain that wasn't replicated hemispherically. It was
because it's right in the centre and there's just one
exactly.
of them. Exactly.
Yeah. And he was like, there's this thing, the homunculus, the cogito, that sits there controlling our bodies like a puppet. Yeah. And lots of animals don't have minds at all. You know, the way in which a sheep reacts, says Descartes, to a wolf, it can be explained in completely mechanistic terms. There's no need for consciousness to intervene in that process whatsoever. And that's still the kind of this binary between mind and body, between brains and minds, between the emergent properties of consciousness, what things feel like, the qualia or qualia in the philosophical language of having a mind as opposed to how our bodies move through the world, has led to all sorts of kind of metaphysical confusions. I mean, philosophers of mind love quite mad thought experiments, and one of those is the idea of the philosophical zombie. I'm not sure if that's
I've not heard of this.
Is that you're never sure that anyone else exists but you?
Well, that's kind of solipsism, I would suggest, but the philosophical zombie is that there's nothing inherent to behaviour that demonstrates the necessity for attendant conscious states. So just because you're acting as though you're interested in what I'm saying right now and nodding along, and I'm reading that body language and thinking, oh, I'm saying interesting stuff.
It could be a kind of Matrix-style illusion.
Or an automaton. You could be just a very well-built machine that's nodding along in response to what I'm saying, just as Descartes viewed the... And I think what the novel can do, and often has tried to do throughout the last 500 years, because it's a form, a literary form, that only really emerges with this notion of the mind. You know, we're in the English, the British novel, the first one is probably Robinson Crusoe, so it's kind of 17th century form that emerges alongside modern conceptions of the individual and the idea that it's worth recording the experiences, perceptions and feelings of an individual.
I think it's so interesting. So before 17th century, we didn't really kind of write stories about individuals.
Well, we did, but they were different kinds of individuals. They were mythical beings, or they were magical, or they were romances in the French Romance tradition. They were knights in armour. So there's a long tradition of
story
collections.
They were almost kind of stereotypes rather than an individual with their own nuances.
Yeah, and so the picaresque novel, if you think of things like Tom Jones or indeed Robinson Crusoe, which is about a normal person just gets stranded on an island and weird things happen to him, but essentially he's just trying to get on. That's something that wouldn't have presented itself as a possible form of literature 100 years previous. Okay. And another interesting thing about the novel is that it often kind of piggybacked on other literary forms in its early stages because it had this claim to realism that we now accept but early readers wouldn't have at all. So the idea that a fictional world could be read for its own terms and wasn't a waste of time. So Robinson Crusoe had to pretend that it was the true account of a diary of a guy who'd been trapped on an island. Or if you think of the epistolary novel in the 17th century, which was written as a series of exchanged letters, they had to kind of trick their readers into thinking they were reading. And nowadays we just suspend our disbelief. We're happy to, because we're familiar with the form. But I think this kind of Cartesian idea of mind-body dualism kind of defines what the post-Enlightenment person was thought to consist of throughout culture in philosophy and science, and led to, you know, psychology and psychiatry in the 20th century. But it took a long time.
The idea that there was a mind at all and that that could change or be broken, I suppose, is the foundation of psychology and trying to pin down what is the little man in your pineal gland, which to me, the way you've described it, is almost like, I suppose, the old-fashioned idea of that would have been like, that's your soul and your soul controls all these feelings.
I think that's exactly right. It kind of Cartesian dualism replaced, or I mean, it's still, the soul was still in play in Descartes' system, but I think by not provide, but by suggesting that the soul didn't necessarily have to take its instruction from, you know, God or some higher being. It wasn't a transcendental thing. It was just a different substance that had its own rules. Gradually, the kind of the idea of a soul as something completely divorced from our concerns here on Earth was replaced by an idea that a parallel discourse could emerge that could treat the soul, the mind, just as much as medicine could treat the body.
I want to go back to something we were saying earlier on about kind of events changing the way people thought about things as well. And you've said before how sort of last century or a couple of centuries ago, psychiatry was very gendered, and actually your gender was seen as a reason.
It probably still is, actually, isn't it?
I think it's still quite gendered, but not nearly as much. Mm. I mean, I talked about that wandering room in my opening, and obviously men don't have wombs, and I think men weren't considered to be hysterical. And what kind of changed that to make it a bit more even, that we realised that men can have mental health as well?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a kind of sad truth that psychiatry as a science has often been moved on, a bit like medicine, actually, most quickly by times of horror, by wars. If you think of, I mean, even kind of plastic surgery, the advance in plastic surgery during the First and Second World Wars.
Oh, yeah, that's so true.
Because you had so many broken
burns.
Bodies, yeah. So techniques that we now use day to day were developed. But pilots, I think, what do they call them? The guinea pig squadron in the Second World War, these pilots that were terribly burned often provided the raw material for the discovery.
From how
of
we now have nose jobs.
Yeah, completely. And I think a similar case could be made for kind of psychiatry, especially during the First World War, when the idea of shell shock emerges. You know, you have a generation of young men sent off, and they come back with deep psychological wounds that manifest in the kinds of behaviors that had previously been associated, as you say, with hysteria, this feminine condition that was associated in the 19th century with a material cause. It was said that women had, you know, weaker nerves, and therefore the stresses and strains
and it was
of modernity
inbuilt into our bodies and stuff.
Yeah. So it was a material explanation in a way that's strikingly modern, but actually it targeted and it used a completely ridiculous kind of characterization of the nervous system and what it, and how the world interacted with that nervous system, especially in female bodies. And so the cure for hysteria for a long time was the rest cure. They locked you away in a room and you weren't allowed to read or do anything.
It's kind of like the mad wife in Jane Eyre up
completely
in the attic, shut away from the world.
Yeah. And so women's bodies were controlled in and, you know, it was nothing, whatever they said was irrelevant to the treatment of them. It was just a bodily problem that they had if they had hysteria. So kind of contemporary psychiatrists would have thought. But then in the Second World War, you got this generation of men coming back from the front with men demonstrating all these kind of strange behaviours. And the idea of hysteria being a female malady had to be exploded because men weren't able to confess to feeling. So in a sense, I think what we would now call PTSD and what was called for a time shell shock was an attempt to kind of update or rebrand an existing set of conditions in a way that made it more acceptable socially for men to manifest them.
Yeah.
And you get that, I think, a lot in contemporary wars too. I think PTSD is a really good analogue. Like, people want a real condition that they can say, I'm suffering from this, and not feel ashamed by the fact that
because I've seen this horrific thing. And
it's unlike the original kind of female, it's in your body. It's like, no, I experienced a trauma.
Well, actually not. I mean, because originally shell shock was thought of in material terms very much. It was thought that, you know, it was literally the loud bangs and the closeness to an explosion that was affecting men's nerves in the same way that women's nerves, because they were weaker, were getting affected by trains and, you know, like cars and backfiring and stuff. So it wasn't quite...
It was a slow update. They kind of incorporated it into their current thinking.
Shell shock allowed men to experience the kind of neurological, as it was thought, trauma and fatigue that women had been feeling. But and a lot of work was done to kind of bring psychoanalysis and the idea of the story of a patient's own life into bear on that kind of therapeutic angle. But that happened quite a lot later, I think, in the mainstream, in Britain and America at any rate.
But I think it's important, just because we're talking in Mental Health Week, to, you know, make the point that men still find it really difficult to talk about their mental health, and socially and culturally it's not as accepted
yet
as women talking about their mental health. And
it's, you know, it's shocking and sobering statistics on suicide rates under 40s men in the Western world. It's terrifying. And I think, again, another thing that fiction and literature and thinking with language can do is kind of encourage and help people share their own stories, which, whether you subscribe to a kind of Freudian paradigm of the talking cure or not, is clearly a good thing. The kind of the public discussion of ideas of about how mental health kind of manifests, but also how it's changed over time, I think is a really important part of the discussion.
Absolutely. I'm going to stop you there because I want to save the talking cure for a later section. And also because we need to fit in some music. So what is your second song?
My second song is a song I heard a few years ago. And I loved it. And the guy who made it is very hard to track down. And he was meant to be releasing an album for a long time. And I think that seems to have vanished or bits of it were leaked. So this might be his only production, which is a wonderful thing in itself. It's BTSTU by Jai Pool.
Panic. You open your mouth, open it so wide your jaws creak. You order your lungs to draw air. Now, you need air. You need it now. But your airways ignore you. They collapse, tighten, squeeze, and suddenly you're breathing through a drinking straw. Your mouth closes and your lips purse, and all you can manage is a croak. Your hands wriggle and shake. Somewhere a dam has cracked open and a flood of cold sweat spills, drenches your body. You want to scream. You would if you could. But you have to breathe to scream. Panic. That's by Kala Tissoni, the kite runner.
Amazing bit of writing. I think it really captures a panic attack like so well. So this is our interactive section where we are going to talk about things that we have read that have changed the way we saw or thought about different experiences of the world. And I have chosen, I'm sure many of you will know it, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, where the main character, Christopher, has Asperger's. And I just found, so it's all written in his narrative point of view, and it really, this section that I'm going to read to you now, just really clearly captured for me how one aspect of Asperger's is often a difficulty in filtering, that everyone in the world, we have all this information coming to us all the time, and our brains learn to prioritise what's important to pay attention to, and that for many people with Asperger's, that prioritisation doesn't really happen. And so that reflects in his amazing memory and in a lot of his incredible detailed descriptions that he gives. And so this is what he says about it. Most people are lazy. They never look at everything. They do what is called glancing, which is the same word for bumping off something and carrying on in almost the same direction, e.g. when a snooker ball glances off another snooker ball and the information in their head is really simple. For example, if they are in the countryside, it might be, one, I'm standing in a field that's full of grass. Two, there are some cows in the field. Three, it is sunny with a few clouds. But if I am standing in a field in the countryside, I notice everything. For example, I remember standing in a field on Wednesday, 15th of June, 1994, because mother and father and I were driving to Dover to get a ferry to France, and we did what father called taking the scenic route, which means going by little roads and stopping for lunch in a pub garden. There were 19 cows in the field, 15 of which are black and white, and 4 of which are brown and white. There is a village in the distance, which has 31 visible houses and a church with a square tower and not a spire. There are ridges in the fields, which means that in medieval times it was called a ridge and furrow field, and people who lived in the village would have each had a ridge to do farming on. There is an old plastic bag from Asda in the hedge, and a squashed Coca-Cola can with a snail on it, and a long piece of orange string. The northeast corner of the field is the highest, and the southwest corner is the lowest. I had a compass because we were going on holiday, and I wanted to know where Swindon was when we were in France. Yeah, I just thought that the whole book kind of captures that aspect beautifully.
It does. I think, I mean, that's one thing that fiction can do, give us the sense that we're inhabiting another point of view, if not another mind. And I'm going to read something that does something very similar and is kind of canonically famous for doing so. So we talked about Woolf earlier, Virginia Woolf, and this is from her novel Mrs. Dalloway. And it's what Woolf did so kind of eloquently in that essay Modern Fiction that we read at the beginning is suggest that what a novel can do is kind of get us closer to the internal thought stream of a character than a kind of scientific paper can, or indeed even a novel written in the kind of first person that like A Curious Incident, because there we're getting a kind of narrated, someone's telling a story to us, you know, there's a first person pronoun, whereas one of Woolf and James Joyce's great innovations was to kind of do away with that positioning. So this is a section that describes the experience of Septimus Warren Smith, who is a soldier who's returned from the First World War, one of the people we were talking about in the previous section, suffering from some sort of malady that we don't actually know what it is. And it's clear that Wolf had in mind something like shell shock, but actually the way she describes his symptoms are very much like those she experienced herself, and would probably now be diagnosed as something akin to schizophrenia. Men must not cut down trees. There is a God. He noted such revelations on the backs of envelopes. Change the world. No one kills from hatred. Make it known. He wrote it down. He waited. He listened. A sparrow perched on the railing opposite chirped, "Septimus, Septimus," 4 or 5 times over, and went on, drawing its notes out to sing freshly and piercingly in Greek. Words, how there is no crime, and joined by another sparrow, they sang in voices prolonged and piercing in Greek words, from trees in the meadow of life beyond a river, where the dead walk, how there is no death. There was his hand, there the dead. White things were assembling behind the railings opposite, but he dared not look. Evans was behind the railings. "What are you saying?" said Retzia suddenly, sitting down by him. "Interrupting again." She was always interrupting.
That's beautiful.
What's interesting about that novel is that Septimus Smith is then taken to a series of nerve specialists with names like Holmes, as in Sherlock Holmes, and Bradshaw, these kind of...
detectives to work out what's wrong with him.
Exactly, and they treat his body and they say, "You must have a sense of proportion, young man," and yet we as readers of the novel are kind of in this anguished thought stream experiencing something of what he's seeing. And Wolf herself, as I said, kind of knew firsthand the discombobulating, terrifying nature of kind of psychotic episodes and the delusion shoot. So Septimus there saying the birds are speaking Greek, that's something that Wolf herself describes in her journals during some of her psychotic episodes.
Wow. I think that's also what you were saying before about how, you know, we wouldn't all be reading scientific papers, and we're so much more likely to read a story. And I guess her doing that and her having that male character with all of those thoughts and experiences really helped to kind of challenge that idea that men couldn't have feelings.
There's a kind of destigmatizing process that I think Wolf was definitely responsible for to a degree. I mean, I think the kind of counterpoint to that, and some scientists and psychiatrists in particular might say that one thing that fiction's kind of potency enables it sometimes to misrepresent conditions and not just literature, film too. I mean, Asperger's, I think, and autism generally is a very interesting case. Think of the problems of like the Rain Man thesis, this idea that I think lots of people who...
the kind of savant.
Quite, exactly. What's your special skill is something that you shorthand often ask of autistic persons. Mm. And that's a kind of a mischaracterization. Lots of people working with or suffering from or with autism object to that idea that, you know, why should one expect a special skill? And I think in some capacities, culture can kind of inculcate or generate characterizations and cliches and stereotypes about mental health, which aren't particularly useful. So it's a
double-sided
careful
coin.
Thing. Yeah, yeah, I think we have to
walk a fine line.
Quite.
Iman.
And actually, on that note, I was very wary of this poem that I've chosen. I really love Robert Browning. He's one of my favourite poems, and I love his poems. And Porphyria's Lover is a poem that I love, but I'm also very wary of depicting mental health in a way that is scary or dangerous or violent. But this poem I've chosen because I think there's the last couple of lines particularly, and I really love the reading by Tom O'Bedlam, just give me chills every time I listen to it. There's a very human sense of being kind of angry and reacting in a very human sense to wanting something. And I think that Robert Browning is very good at kind of depicting and working with, you know, human intention and the way that we feel. Although this is quite violent, and I just want to make that disclaimer that not all mental health conditions are violent.
Absolutely. So unfortunately we won't have time for the whole poem to be read out. So this is the actual reading by Tom O'Bedlam that you mentioned. You can find it on YouTube, and we've started at 1:40.
That moment she was mine. Mine, fair, perfectly pure and good. I found a thing to do, and all her hair in one long yellow string I wound, three times her little throat around, and strangled her. No pain felt she, I am quite sure she felt no pain. As a shut bud that holds a bee, I wearily oped her lids. Again laughed the blue eyes without a stain. And I untightened next the tress about her neck. Her cheek once more blushed bright beneath my burning kiss. I propped her head up as before, only this time my shoulder bore her head, which droops upon it still. The smiling, rosy little head, so glad it has its utmost will, and all it scorned at once is fled, and I, its love, am gained instead. Porphyria's love, she guessed not how her darling one wish would be heard, and thus we sit together now, and all night long we have not stirred. And yet God has not said a word.
Every time, just those last couple of lines always get me.
Yeah, that's powerful.
Yeah.
John, what is your next song and why?
My next song, I recently bought an accordion on eBay. Yeah, and I can play two songs on it now.
Amazing.
One is the theme from Amelie, and the other is Where Do You Go To, My Lovely by Peter Starter, which is kind of a creepy, horrible song in many ways. I think the lyrics are a bit weird. I want to get inside your head and all that. But
relevant to today's show.
Well, quite possibly. So, that's my next pick.
You go to the embassy parties where you talk in Russian and Greek. Oh, and the young men who move in your circle, they hang on every word you speak. Oh, yes, they do. But where do you go to, my lovely? When you're alone in your bed, or tell me the thoughts that surround you. I want to look inside your head, yes I do. Oh, I've seen all your qualifications that you got from the Sorbonne, and the painting that you stole from Picasso. Your loveliness, it goes on and on.
I have not always been a psychotherapist. Like other neuropathologists, I was trained to employ local diagnosis and electroprognosis. And still it strikes me myself as strange that the case histories I should write read like short stories, and that, as one might say, they lack the serious stamp of science. That's Freud, Studies on Hysteria, 1895.
Should have brought my accordion in.
That would have been amazing. I think, although a lot of what Freud has done has been mainly like kind of ridiculed as being too kind of sexually focused or maybe discredited, I do think a lot of his work was kind of really instrumental in bringing about that the importance that we still think now of your own personal narrative in shaping your experiences of the world and your mental health. I mean, we were talking before about people explaining hysteria and shell shock as experiences of the body that the nerves couldn't cope with. And when did that all start to kind of change?
Well, I think with Freud, really, yeah. I think whatever his reputation nowadays, I don't think anyone can deny the kind of historical importance of the paradigm shift that he instantiated with Bühler and a couple of other people. I mean, as that quote suggests, he studied as a neurologist professionally for many years, and then in the 1890s he started getting interested in hypnosis and as a treatment for hysteria. And this was a time when kind of the fledgling psychiatric movements were very kind of theatrical and pseudo-scientific in many ways. You know, mesmerism was on the ascendant. People were kind of giving public demonstrations of hypnosis.
Quackery.
But it wasn't, you know, the boundaries between quackery and what was science were very much more fluid, perhaps, than they might be seen to be nowadays. And actually, many of the kind of great innovations from this period are we now think of as quackery. I mean, it's no more, I think, discredited than the idea of the ether being an important kind of developmental process in physics, to think that mesmerism perhaps played an important role within the development of...
And for anyone who hasn't heard of it before, what is mesmerism?
Mesmerism was a kind of pseudo-movement associated with a guy whose first name I forget, called Mesmer, who gave these... He talked about magnetism of the body and the way in which he could kind of control bodies through these invisible psychic forces. They weren't psychic for him, they were kind of physical, they were about magnetism. So he was one of a number of people, Bühler was another, Freud was another, who were kind of interested in the way in which hysteria could kind of unrepress emotions,
suppressed emotions, completely. But they're still kind of using the body to get
very
to
much
them.
So yeah. Very much so, yeah. So this is the important thing, and actually Freud gives up on hysteria fairly soon because he's crap at it, you know. He tries to hypnotize these people and they just kind of ignore him, so he can't do it. And he realizes that actually just talking to people and listening to their stories does seem to have an effect on how their symptoms are manifested, and that's the starting point really for everything we think of now as Freudian psychoanalysis. The idea that what one of his patients called the talking cure, you didn't need to treat a body as a thing to be locked away in a room, you know, and given the rest cure. You could treat the mind as an entity that required its own set of therapeutic practices to be healed. And whatever you think of the kind of phallocentric theories of Freud and psychoanalysis, I think that idea is one that it's essentially governed one kind of school or class of psychiatry ever since. I mean, what's significant also, I think, about that quotation that you read from a kind of literary perspective is that it's a great boon to literary studies, right? As soon as Freud comes along and says stories are really important, let's listen to them in a kind of medical context, then literary critics can go, yeah, brilliant, I'm gonna plumb the psychic depths of these characters. And Freud himself was a great reader. Think of the names of, you know, the Oedipus complex, you know, he reaches, all his readings are based on the canon.
That's so true.
Shakespeare and Greek myth
And I think we've come full circle, really, because I think in the last couple of years we've had the rise of Headspace, the meditation app, and talking therapies and alternative therapies being on the NHS, as an alternative to antidepressants and more.
I was about to say, it's almost like we went into this period, like I mentioned, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where it was all about drugs, and we suddenly had this understanding that there were chemicals in the brain and we could influence them.
Cracked it.
And that's clearly not all it is. And we're coming back to this idea that actually it's about sort of accepting everything that you are and everything that you've experienced it, and facing those and not repressing them.
As someone studying neuroscience, I like that it's not all biochemical and that, you know, there's a feeling and a kind of...
So, listeners,
I'm gesturing with my hands. I don't have the words. I don't know.
Like a kind of floaty wave.
A kind of fluid motion that's not science and empirical. I like that.
I mean, even within the, the discredited psychoanalysis had a pretty bad rep. I mean, one reason for its great kind of cultural popularity in the 20th century was again war-related, I think. You had a generation of Jewish psychoanalysts, you know, Freudian-trained, who then were exiled to America during the Second World War and popularized this activity, analysis, and that's, you know, where Hollywood went with the idea of the figure of the analyst and the analysand.
And lying on the divan.
Yeah, so it's a massively kind of culturally generated idea, and one that, as we've said, was discredited in the sort of 60s and 70s by the pharmacological term. But actually, what's interesting, I think, is that recently a lot of research has shown that some of the alternatives to psychoanalysis that aren't pharmacological, such as CBT and other kind of instantiations,
are one of the most effective.
Well, are becoming less effective now.
Really?
So CBT apparently doesn't work as well as it did 10 years ago. It's partly a kind of familiarity thing, people think. So part of what maybe made CBT effective was a kind of novelty-based placebo effect. Mm. And actually, psychoanalysis is in the resurgence in some capacity. The reason it was kind of not formalized in the NHS is because it's quite expensive. You have to see your analyst three times a week for 5 years, you know, to get anywhere, and everyone needs it, according to
classical
Freudian
union.
Yeah,
a lot of people.
Exactly. But actually, it's I think the idea of listening to someone's story being an important social function of the healthcare system is becoming more possible as CBT's efficacy seems to decline. I mean, there's loads of other attendant kind of approaches to mental health, and I think really the best, if there is such a thing, is probably a suite of different approaches. You know, often drugs are a very, very brilliant way of, you know...
Or at least getting back to kind of a stable point where then you're able to benefit more from thinking and talking and facing the feelings.
And the revolution in SSRIs, whatever we make of literary representations like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, have saved lives. There's no doubt about that. They are kind of incredibly effective in some capacities. And the fears that have that are generated by books like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and a kind of Foucauldian analysis of the power dynamics inherent in the kind of institution of the scary asylum as a place where we lock up our mentally ill people.
It's separate from the actual kind of drugs themselves and how they're used today. Absolutely. Yeah. I also think what we were saying about the importance of your story being heard, that's another kind of function of literature, because you can come across, you can read someone else's story that you see elements of your own in, and immediately you feel kind of less alone, and like you, it might help you to feel like you have an understanding of what you've been feeling because someone else has managed to crystallize it into words for you. And being able to put names to things and words to things is so beneficial.
Mm. I think so, yeah. Making you feel like you're not alone, as you say. There's the other side of that, which is that, you know, there's plenty of evidence that writing is a therapeutic act too. So it's not just that you come across someone else who's described your conditions, but in the kind of Freudian sense that you're, you know, describing your own experience.
You're analyzing yourself. Yeah. On that note, what is your fourth song?
My fourth song is a Vaughan Williams' setting of Silent Noon, sung by Anthony Rolfe Johnson. It's a piece of music I really love, and this particular rendition of it. Anthony Rolfe Johnson was a farmer until he was in his 30s, I think, and then discovered, he always had a great voice, but then discovered that he could be a professional and became one of the great singers of our time.
The finger points look through like rosy blooms. Your eyes smile peace. The pasture gleams and glooms neath billowing skies that scatter and amass.
News just in. The most contaminated killer whale on the planet.
Human-robot interactions take step forward with emotional chatbot.
Pigeons have a cumulative culture.
A skin patch costing 39p could save the lives of stroke victims, researchers say.
Albatrosses counted from space.
John, tell us about this pigeon culture thing.
Well, I've recently got quite into pigeons. I've got a loft in my garden that now currently has 15 homing pigeons in it, racing pigeons, and the way in which homing pigeons home is an ongoing and elusive mystery.
So you race pigeons?
Yes, I'm a man of the fancy.
That's amazing. So,
haven't started racing them yet. I've only had them a couple of months, but I'm training them. And yeah, there's loads of theories as to how pigeons home. You know, they obviously, like many birds, use sun to get their longitude, but there's also these theories that they use smell and infrasonic sound
and even landmarks as well.
Well, they certainly use visual clues when they get close to the loft,
like they'll follow kind of roads.
And also that they might detect magnetic fields. But there's a recent paper written by Tako Sasaki and Dora Biro of the Oxford Navigation Group, where they've discovered that pigeons are one of the few, there's very few creatures that manifest this notion of kind of cumulative culture. So they're teaching, they basically released pairs of birds and rotated the pairing so that they had different experiences of homing on a particular route, and they found that they can teach each other collectively as a group to become more efficient homing pigeons on particular routes. And this is something that's previously only been observed in fairly sophisticated animals.
So is that like
chimps,
the older ones kind of showing the younger ones?
Yeah, and cross-generational too, you know, a bird that won't have had experience of the same route. So they're calling this a culture, which I think is an intriguing term to use in this context. Weirdly, what they conclude is that unlike the higher primates, this kind of cumulative culture doesn't generate more complexity within a society, but simply generates more efficiency. So unlike chimps or so, or, you know, who learn and pass on how to crack a nut with a tool, it's not that they're generating new behaviours necessarily, it's just that they're performing their old behaviours in a new way.
More efficient, yeah, getting home more quickly.
Quite.
Which is exactly what you need if you want them to win that race.
I know, maybe I should send them off to the Oxford Navigation School for training.
Get some cultural training. So my story, I just thought this sounded so interesting. A skin patch, when you have a stroke, it's caused by like an artery clot or a burst blood vessel in the brain, and this can cause a permanent disability in about a quarter of patients who receive a stroke. And this new patch has been developed containing glycerol trinitrate, and it lowers your blood pressure and helps the blood vessels to dilate and open up. So before if it gets put onto your skin really quickly, it can,
during a stroke,
The stroke has kind of occurred, it can really quickly help to reopen that blocked blood vessel and limit the damage caused, because obviously that damage is caused by the brain tissue losing oxygen. Mm-hmm. So if you can make sure that the blood gets back to it, that damage won't happen.
So will that join defibrillators in those little red, yellow boxes across the land?
I don't know. I mean, it was a small study, and it was done at Nottingham, and they found that it halved the death rate from strokes, which was originally 38% down to 16% in their study. So British Heart Foundation are fully funding it, and I think this is one to watch. Iman, your story.
I'm about to completely ruin the pronunciation of this name, and I apologise. But Minli Huang, a computer scientist at Tsinghua University, so a Chinese team came up with this algorithm that read human emotion from social media and kind of learnt appropriate examples of how to respond to questions. And so this human robot was kind of designed with an emotional capacity. So it's called the emotional chatbot. And it can respond with happy, sad, angry, disgusted, or a kind of liking response. And scientists think that it's kind of one step closer to having personal assistants, but it's also, although it's got its uses, so it would be quite useful for using this kind of technology for children who have autism, for example. The problem with that is that children might share data and we don't know where that might go. There's also marketing. So if companies realize that we buy more things when we're bored or we're sad or angry, you know, we can manipulate there are definitely bad ways of using this technology, as well as kind of creating real feeling relationships and duping people that way. And of course we've got the very famous example of Microsoft's Tay, who became a neo-Nazi after one day of being unleashed on Twitter. 24 hours neo-Nazi. So we're not quite there yet, but I think it's really, really interesting that we can kind of generate human robot interactions and create a sense of emotional dialogue. I think that's cool.
Very Black Mirror. It kind of speaks to what you were mentioning before the show about neuromania coming back round, and, you know, with artificial intelligence, what is a mind? And
It's kind of Alan Turing's question, isn't it? You know, the great computer scientist and pioneer and Enigma code cracker
it's quite a CV.
Yeah, he's a hero. And he came up famously with in a paper called Can Machines Think, with this idea of the imitation game, hence the film, or the Turing test, where to answer the question, can machines think, we simply need to engage in a dialogue, a text-based dialogue with some sort of system. And if it can fool us into thinking it's human, then to all intents and purposes, says Turing, it is human. Philosophers of mind have said that what that instantiation ignores is the idea that there are affective mental states that attend our communication with others that doesn't test for. So the idea of this category that philosophers love to, I mentioned before, I think qualia or qualia, the what is it likeness of experience. It goes back to the philosophical zombie. Even if a system could trick me into thinking that it was human, does that constitute enough? Does that confirm that system has experiences, has mental experiences that attend those states? It seems to be an open question, but an interesting one.
What do you think is, where do you think kind of our ideas might be in the future?
I think what's really striking from my own research is just how persistent kind of models of brain, mind, dualism have been and continue to be. So every generation you get a series of neuroscientists or philosophers going, I'm going to do away with the Cartesian paradigm. Probably the most prominent in our own time is Daniel Dennett, who is really against the kind of qualia theory of consciousness. And he says, no, we are just our brains. It's totally fine. And here's how we are. And then he, in a book, Consciousness Explained, he kind of riffs on how that might work. And I mean, I'm none the wiser, and many people call that book Consciousness Explained away. Yeah. I mean, he kind of says it's no great mystery. He comes up with his model of consciousness called the multiple drafts model. I mean, you can have a look at the book. It's brilliantly written, and he's a really engaging person. But I think probably these questions are going to be solved by practical scientists, neurology and neuroscience, rather than philosophers speculating on the existence of qualia.
Do you think they can be solved?
Well, possibly not. That's an interesting point too. I mean, Wittgenstein, in a kind of philosophical perspective, I think Wittgenstein rendered all of these kinds of formulations irrelevant. I'm just not quite clever enough to work out quite how he did so.
It's kind of what you were saying at the beginning, though, like, consciousness does seem to be the like next frontier in psychology. It's like, how do we define what makes us kind of separate from a lot of other animals, and what is that?
And then how do we transpose
can we create it in AI?
But it could just be a repository for all our superstitions about humanitas, about what it is to be human. It could be this magical algebraic X that we just load on, a bit like God is now in contemporary theology. You know, it's a consciousness is a phenomenon of the gaps that we're constantly saying, machines can do this and this, they can play chess now, but they can't really think, they can't really feel. You know, we're constantly redefining what those capacities are. And actually, I think, in my heart of hearts, though I defend the novel and though I defend philosophy of mind, and I think these questions are kind of fascinating, I think they'll be rendered kind of weirdly out of date, in the same way that paradigm shifts in physics have rendered out of date the notion of discovering the ether. I think a similar kind of conceptual shift will what's strange, I think, is that how persistent, you know, from Descartes to now, we're still basically dealing with the same concepts in a very similar way. We haven't gone beyond those yet, and perhaps, and we might in 10 years. Seems unlikely to me. I mean, the 90s were the decade of the brain, when there was massive government funding, especially in America, to pursue these kinds of questions, and they didn't seem to get anywhere in particular. So,
but I also, like you were saying at the beginning, it's almost quite reductionist, and there's a part of me, the romantic part, that doesn't want consciousness to be defined. I like to feel that there's a thing that's me, and I don't know how to tell you what it is, but it's me, and that's good enough. I can just share what it's like to be me without trying to explain why I am.
Yeah. Or maybe that's why we, you know, write books and make art and make music to express that, to itch,
that part that
to
we can't that express itch in a scientific, reductive way.
Yeah, and maybe that's fine. Maybe just being a phenomenon of the gaps is kind of a completely legitimate thing to be.
I'm afraid we're going to have to cut your. You have to choose for your final song. We don't have time to play both of them.
Okay.
I apologise for
putting
that.
Putting me on the spot, that's all right.
No, it's fine. You have time to think. Okay. Because we also have to reveal the answer to our trivia brain teaser. Iman, have we had any guesses in on Twitter?
Yes, but no correct answers, I'm afraid. So I'm quite pleased with myself. I think I've done quite well this week.
That's a hard task. We had a guest in the studio. What was your guess, John?
I thought it sounded like something one of the kind of pre-science fiction writers of the 19th century would have come up with, like Jules Verne or H.G. Wells in one of his scientific romances, but I detect that I'm not right.
Absolutely wrong.
Good.
So, so just a reminder, the brain teaser was, which 19th century piece of literature came up with the Big Bang Theory before the scientists? And the answer to that brain teaser is the literary work Eureka by Edgar Allan Poe. And I'll read a little extract now, and I think in it you can find... I think you'll see what I mean by the creation of the Big Bang Theory. So, were the succession of stars endless, then the background of the sky would present us a uniform luminosity like that displayed by the galaxy, since there could be absolutely no point in all that background at which would not exist a star. The only mode, therefore, in which, under such a state of affairs, we could comprehend the voids which our telescopes find in innumerable directions, would be supposing the distance of the invisible background so immense that no ray from it has yet been able to reach us at all.
Wow.
I know.
That's incredible.
So just to dissect that a little bit, because I'll be honest, it went straight over my head. It relies on kind of three very general principles, and one is that I think within the text there is this understanding that light is fast but not instantaneous, and its speed can be measured. If you find that, let me know, because I couldn't, so this analysis is brilliant. Secondly, that space is enormous.
And that the light travelling to us is coming, has had to travel, so we can see back in time when we see that light.
It has not reached us yet.
Which is really cool.
And the third principle, that the universe must be a finite age. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know how
does
did
that
it,
tick all
I
the boxes?
Brilliant. Yeah. There we go. Amazing. Big Bang Theory.
And John, your final song.
My final song is Passing Me By the Far Side.
And because why?
I don't know. I just like it a lot.
Good enough. Thank Fair you enough. So much for joining us today. It's been absolutely
pleasure.
Fantastic.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, wow. I wish I could hold her hand and give her a hug. She was married to the man. He was a thug. His name was Lee. He drove a Z. I was on her dock. Yes, indeedy. I wrote graffiti on the bus. First, I write her name, then carve a bus with my name last on the looking glass. I seen her yesterday, but still I had to let her pass.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.
Science.